injuring at least 46,000 others in just 2 months of conflict.
This way, the U.S. continues to back Israel's extermination of Palestinians with the goal to drive our people out of Gaza towards Egypt, and after that, to drive our people out of the West Bank towards Jordan. Israel is the watchdog of the colonialist Western Empire in the Middle East, period.
The remaining 13 of the 15 current members of the United Nations Security Council voted in favor of the resolution put forward by the United Arab Emirates and co-sponsored by 100 other countries, while the United Kingdom abstained. The role of the European Union in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was also discussed at the conference. So far, EU's political leaders have been mostly speaking with one voice, backing Netanyahu and continuously reaffirming that Israel has the right to defend itself without any reference to the fact that Tel Aviv is an occupying force which is perpetrating crimes against humanity in Gaza on a daily basis.
Unfortunately, the EU has lost its status as a significant player. When a major war breaks out, all vassal entities tend to line up with the hegemony. The EU today overlooks the interests of its people and has given up its role of impartial mediator in any future peace process in order to accommodate US requests.
The Rome conference ended with a focus on the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces have intensified their attacks there. Max Civili, Rome.
Signaling the dawn of a new era of enhanced cooperation. Less than 6 months after the Iranian president's historic trip to Damascus, Syria's prime minister is in Tehran with a high-ranking delegation for a three-day visit that will include meetings with Iran's president, the parliament speaker, and the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, all in line with the implementation of bilateral agreements signed during President Raisi's visit to Syria back in May. The Syrian prime minister signed 6 agreements with Iran's vice president Mohammad Mokhber that will pave the way for taking practical measures to boost cooperation based on the bilateral agreements.
Strengthening ties with Syria is among Iran's strategies that leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has always emphasized, and Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has also pursued. We are determined to broaden economic cooperation with Syria. Our main priority is peace and security in the region and the independence and welfare of the Syrian people.
Both Iran and Syria are now looking forward to strengthen ties in various areas, including trade, oil and energy, engineering, housing, communications and technology, as well as tourism and pilgrimage to holy sites. In this regard, developing transportation routes between the two countries has been one of the major achievements of the top Syrian official's trip to Tehran.
Our countries have deep-rooted historical and strategic ties, and the Syrian nation will never forget the Iranian government and people's support at times of need. Iran can play a significant role in the reconstruction of Syria, and we consider Iran a major partner in this process.
The visit comes as the Iran-Syria Joint Economic Commission is underway in Tehran, holding its 15th round of meetings, which the Syrian prime minister has attended in order to give the go-ahead for implementing bilateral trade agreements, most notably setting up a free trade zone and removing trade tariffs based on the free trade deal between Tehran and Damascus. With the Syrian prime minister's trip to Tehran and the implementation of bilateral agreements, Iran and Syria are now closer than ever, entering a new era of strengthened ties and enhanced cooperation. Gisum Jahmadi, Tehran.
The streets of the Yemeni capital were once again the scene of a pro-Palestinian protest, condemning the 2 months of Israeli genocide against the Palestinians. Protesters shouted anti-US and Israeli slogans and denounced all those who are supporting the continuous Israeli war crimes in the Gaza Strip.
No matter how many people betray the people of Palestine, and no matter how many presidents and governments side with the Israeli regime, the people of Yemen are ready to support Palestine with money, weapons, and we are also ready to fight alongside our Palestinian brothers.
Prominent Ansarullah official Muhammad Ali al-Houthi also slammed the Arab and Islamic world's reluctance to take meaningful actions against Israel to save the lives of Gazans.
The Arab and Islamic world is outraged with what they are seeing in Palestine. We continue to watch the sad and depressing footage coming out of Palestine, but we need to take more actions in every aspect. As the leader of the revolution has said, we need to mobilize more in protesting in our media coverage and also militarily.
Muhammad Ali also addressed U.S. latest plan to form a NATO-like coalition force to protect the Red Sea.
Today, America is calling for the formation of a big coalition which should also include Arab regimes for the protection of the Red Sea. However, we tell those who are thinking about protecting the Red Sea to first protect the Rafah borders before sending your armies against your brothers.
For the time being, Yemen's armed forces will continue to target Israel with drones and ballistic missiles. This in addition to the targeting of any ships linked to the Israeli regime attempting to cross Yemen's Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
The Yemeni armed forces are calling on residents in occupied Palestine to evacuate all areas near Israeli military sites because these are considered legit military targets as long as the regime's onslaught continues on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Since the beginning of Israeli aggression on Gaza, the Indian news channels have been busy debating and only promoting the Israeli side of the narrative. However, protests, gatherings or discussions on Israeli genocide against Palestinians have been strictly forbidden, including in schools, colleges and universities. Experts say this could lead to a greater suppression of Muslims in India and further escalation of Islamophobia.
Islamophobia in India has increased in last 10, 20 years to an extent that anything which is related to Muslims or Islam is seen with suspicion, even hatred. And that's why if you say something which is seen as being sympathetic to Palestinians, that would not be allowed.
Despite Palestinian plight being suppressed in this part of the world, there are many who leave no stone unturned to highlight the issue and enlighten the masses about the real history of the aggression. A case in point was this seminar organized to address human rights violations across the globe, particularly against women and children. The speakers, mostly women, blasted the utter failure of the United Nations to put an end to the Gaza carnage. The participants of the seminar condemned the Israeli onslaught on Gaza, calling it ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
It's also part of a much longer standing suppression of dissent over the last decade, since the BJP came to power, where various events on campus have been cancelled. So anything to do with the constitution, with discussions of human rights, democracy, Kashmir, Maoism, all of these have become taboo subjects. So Palestine has been added to the list of taboo subjects. So there are four reasons. There's a technological arms reason, there's the ideological reason, there's the Islamophobia reason, and there's the longer suppression of dissent reason.
Observers say it's not just the issue of Palestine that is being barred in the academics or criminalized in the public spheres, but the issues related to the Muslims of the country are being sidelined and seen in the prism of rising Islamophobia. Experts say the term Muslim or Islam has become a political tool since decades to garner votes ahead of elections by polarizing voters. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Millay University in Kabul has hosted a pro-Palestine conference dubbed Palestine and the Responsibilities of Islamic Nations, with attendees, including religious scholars, Taliban authorities, university lecturers, and students, discussing the pressing issue of Palestine. Participants voiced their concern and support for Gazans in the face of Israeli brutal aggression, while calling for unity among Muslims. During the conference, rights activists took the stage to draw attention to the egregious human rights violations and atrocities perpetrated by Israel against the Palestinians. They vehemently condemned international inaction and accused the global community of complicity in Israel's crimes. Urging for immediate action, they emphasized the need to exert greater pressure and take concrete steps to bring an end to the occupation and siege in the Palestinian territories. This conference is a means for Afghans to show their support for Palestine. They also urge other Muslims around the world to unite for the cause and victory of Palestinians. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The heads of key religio-political parties and top clerics took part in a national conference titled Security of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Responsibility of Muslims in the Pakistani capital Islamabad on Wednesday. In a collective stance, the heads of religious groups and leaders of political parties designated December 8th as the National Day of Protection of Al-Aqsa Mosque, during which they intend to stage nationwide protests to denounce Israel's massacres in Gaza. With the primary objective of tackling security concerns surrounding Al-Aqsa Mosque, the conference has highlighted the importance of preserving the sanctity of this holy site, acknowledging its significance for Muslims worldwide.
We want to tell our government along with the leaders of Islamic states that we will not allow anyone to recognize Israel as a legitimate state. The people of the US and the UK have expressed their support for Palestine by holding historic mass protests against Israel's barbarism in Gaza. If the West respects democracy and public opinion, they should immediately withdraw their support from Israel.
The participants in the event united in their condemnation of the Israeli aggression on Gaza, underscoring a shared commitment to find diplomatic solutions to the long-standing conflict.
The genocide of Palestinians in Gaza is being carried out on a daily basis. The US and Israel are directly responsible for this mass killing. The streets of Gaza will be turned into a graveyard for the Zionist regime in the near future.
Speakers at the conference have referred to massive civilian casualties, infrastructure damage, and the overall humanitarian crisis in the region.
Nobody was watching the atrocities which were being committed before this also. State terrorism. I think it is never seen before in the history of the world. I would go back to Germany and maybe it is worse than that because this kind of bombing was not seen anywhere in the world.
The participants at the conference not only reaffirmed their unwavering commitment to safeguarding the sanctity of Al-Aqsa Mosque, but also made it clear that they are determined to intensify efforts aimed at achieving a complete halt to Israel's aggressive actions in Gaza. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The Islamic Radios and Television Union held a conference in Beirut to denounce the killing of journalists in Palestine and Lebanon and to voice support for the Palestinian people and resistance. The speakers all stressed that the battle of the media is complementary to that of the resistance.
Our media battle is decisive. It began as a very brutal war against us when they tried to portray Hamas as Daesh or ISIS. They slammed any act of resistance against Israel as an aggression and propagated the idea that Hamas kills children and rapes women, and then they tried to sell them to the world. But with God's help and our steadfastness and the strength of our media, their campaign has backfired, And we now see the support of the people in all capitals of the world for Palestine.
The conference also included videos of the correspondents on the field in Gaza, who have transcended all borders and, despite the misinformation campaign, conveyed the truth to the rest of the world.
The resistance media has succeeded despite its limited capacity, since it is always dependent on the truth. The theory attributed to a former German foreign minister is that if you keep repeating a lie, others will eventually believe it. Such a theory could have been possible during a period in history when there was no awareness or knowledge or technology. But today, everyone can recognize the truth. Look where the lies of the U.S. and Israeli have gotten them. The most important power we have now is the truth.
Influential figures and experts stress that the next phase is pivotal, and that the alternative media need to work on promoting the narrative of the free people of the world on a global scale.
The Israeli regime was too late to notice that the resistance was able to let its narrative be heard. And I can tell you with all certainty, and despite all the misinformation and deception practiced for over a month and a half, that the narrative of the resistance and its media has been established. What's important now is how to preserve it. Now this narrative is strong and has spread across the world, but we need to maintain it.
I believe the world is now ready to listen, to look and ponder on the other point of view and the other side of the story. We need to think about what is the discourse that we need to present to the world, what are its terminology and its context. This is part of the meetings and plans for the next phase. That is why it is pivotal to hold such conferences.
Israel has killed over 60 journalists, including female reporters in Gaza, and three in southern Lebanon. Israel has attempted to portray itself as an entity trying to defend itself. Yet the journalists who have put their lives in the line of fire in Gaza have debunked these claims and have shown that it is the Palestinian people who have the right to defend themselves. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
A new survey has found that almost half of British teenagers say that violence or the fear of violence has affected their lives and manifested itself in trouble sleeping, loss of appetite, or difficulty concentrating at school. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. According to a landmark report by the British government advisers into what drives knife crime, bullying and gang rivalries, half of all teenagers witnessed or were victims of violence in England and Wales last year. The largest ever survey in the United Kingdom of youngsters about the problem found shocking and unacceptable levels of youth violence, with 358,000 teenagers physically injured during the last 12 months. According to Youth Endowment Fund, the scale of the problem was also found to be undermining children's education, with one in five teenagers admitting they had skipped school during the last 12 months because they felt unsafe. The Youth Endowment Fund has received £200 million of government funding to prevent serious youth violence and advises the Home Office and senior police officers on what works. The research, which was published on Monday, 13th of November, is based on a detailed survey of 7,500 teenagers and confirms the link between poverty and youth violence. A third of teenagers in families who rely on food banks were found to be victims of violence over the last year. Levels of violence were most pronounced among vulnerable children, with 37% of teenagers who are supported by a social worker admitting that they had been a victim of violence. The finding raises serious questions over the government's approach to tackling youth violence. Critics say it relies too heavily on granting police more powers instead of tackling the root causes of the problem. John Yates, executive director of the Youth Endowment Fund, said, "The public, including my friends, tend to think this issue affects a very small group of people instead of recognizing that actually half of all teenage children are seeing or experiencing violence." John Yates added, "Adults, whether politicians or not, need to recognize that levels of violence are unacceptably high. This is not playground mocking about. When you consider the numbers getting properly injured or changing their behaviour because of fear of violence." However, the Youth Endowment Fund is most concerned over how few perpetrators of violence receive sufficient mentoring or therapy to amend their behaviour. Its research, the first of its kind in Western Europe, found that 9 in 10 teenagers who committed violence that led to physical injury received no subsequent support. Yet studies show that mentoring programs can prevent violence by reducing subsequent incidents by up to 21%. On Saturday, hundreds of mourners lined the route to the funeral of 15-year-old teenager Eliane Andam, who was stabbed to death on her way to school in Croydon, South London. A 17-year-old teenage boy has been charged with her murder. The latest high-profile murder of a teenager was last Tuesday, 7th of November, when 15-year-old Alfie Lewis was stabbed to death near a school in Leeds in Yorkshire. A 14-year-old teenage boy has been charged with his murder. From Monday, 13th of November, many police forces will undertake a week of action to tackle knife crime as part of Operation Skepta, a national initiative which will include educational programs and knife amnesties. Although the Youth Endowment Fund's own studies indicate there is no clear evidence that knife surrender schemes or knife awareness initiatives actually work. The website News Noledia has also covered the same story and tells us more. A new survey found that almost half or 47% of British teenagers said that violence or fear of violence has affected their daily lives and manifested itself in trouble sleeping, in loss of appetite, or concentrating at school. The research also underlined the role of social media in propagating violence, with 4 in 10 teenagers believing that the technology played a role in encouraging violence. John Yates, the executive director of Youth Endowment Fund, said, "The fundamental thing that we all need is safety. If you're struggling to sleep, to travel to school, or go out and meet people because you're afraid, it's pretty hard to get everything else in your life working." When perpetrators of violence were asked why they hurt others, more than half said it was because they felt baited, while bullying and retaliation were other prominent factors. The research, which also interviewed 3,000 adults for their views on the problem of youth violence in the United Kingdom found that teenage children were frequently the victims and the perpetrators of violence, with one in four saying they were both. Another issue was the relatively high rates of violence involving girls, with one in 12 also admitting to perpetrating violence. 7% of girls said they had been victims of sexual violence, compared with 5% of boys. A Home Office spokesperson said, "We're investigating heavily in a twin-track approach to reduce youth violence, which combines early intervention and prevention with tough enforcement measures." The spokesperson for the Home Office added, "Since 2019, we have invested over £170 million into the development of violence reduction units in the 20 areas worst affected by serious violence. This is alongside a further £170 million we have provided to fund additional targeted police patrols, reaching over 215,000 vulnerable young people in this third year of funding alone." The spokesperson claimed, "We're also investing £200 million over 10 years in the Youth Endowment Fund to understand how to better prevent youth violence." The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Research suggests more than half of young people aged between 13 and 17 have seen real-life violence on social media in the past 12 months, including fighting, threats and sexual assaults. A survey carried out on behalf of the Youth Endowment Fund also found that 24% had seen another child carrying a weapon online. The poll of 2,025 teenagers about their experiences of violence revealed that 14% had skipped school because they feared being a victim of violence, while 65% had altered their behaviour, appearance, or where they went to keep themselves safe. John Yates, executive director of the Youth Endowment Fund, said, "Far too many of our children are being exposed to real-life violent content on social media sites, and this matters."
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The Yemeni army has stepped up its anti-Israel measures in reaction to the U.S.-Israeli ethnic cleansing underway in Gaza. Yemen's armed forces have announced they will target all ships destined for Israel unless urgently needed food and medicine are allowed into Gaza. The Yemen army has already seized several Israeli-linked vessels in waters around Yemen. Resistance fighters elsewhere in the region have not sat idle by either. In Iraq, they have staged drone attacks on U.S. military bases on several occasions. And in Lebanon, Hezbollah has been hitting Israeli military bases and Merkava tanks with precision-guided missiles. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this episode. Shabir Razvi, political analyst in London. Also in London, we'll have John Phoenix, journalist and international relations expert.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen in London. Now, beginning with Shabir, the Yemeni reaction to the Israeli-U.S. genocide in Gaza came following multiple warnings, which fell on deaf ears, apparently. And the armed forces in Yemen insist that they will go on with such operations until Israel stops committing crimes against Palestinians in Gaza and allows humanitarian aid to go in. Your initial thoughts on this?
Hello, thanks for the invitation. Firstly, condolences for all the families of the martyrs who have been martyred in the last 60 plus days in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. And our supplications for all those that have been injured and for their families to have patience for the imminent victory. Look, you talked about, you know, falling on deaf ears. What has become abundantly clear is that it's not just deaf ears, but it's actually hubris on steroids, as I would like to call it. Because today we are supposedly marking the 75th anniversary on 10th of December for the Human Rights Day. However, today marks not a day of celebration, but a day of remorse. This was exposed as a lie when the U.S. again vetoed a resolution at the United Nations for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza against an ongoing genocide in real time in front of us, in our hands, on our mobiles. We can see clearly that murder is taking place without any sort of stopping to it. So really, what the resistance is doing at multiple fronts, as you pointed out in your opening comments, particularly the Yemeni sort of resistance, has acted remarkably. What we've got to remember is that a war of 8 years was inflicted on Yemen, and the United Nations at that time had described that this is the biggest human tragedy, man-made tragedy, which was sort of inflicted on the Yemeni people. However, they have been strong. They have been sort of supporting what's happening in Gaza. What you've got to remember also is that in those 8 years, the Houthis and the Yemenis did not sort of stop traffic, the cargoes and the ships going through the Bab el-Mandeb. What they have done now is really in support of the Gazans. And as we said, because the Zionist entity has stopped all kinds of sort of basic necessities to go through to Gaza. So what the Houthis and the Yemenis are doing is saying that, look, this is what we intend to do. And that's what they have done. What it also sort of clearly creates a big problem for Israeli ships and also any other shipping line that wants to take goods to Israel. They have to go all the way to Madagascar, South Africa, and that will sort of increase the cost and also delay. So that will have an impact on the Zionist entity when they're importing products. And you've got to remember that Bab el-Mandeb, a significant amount of gas and petroleum products also pass through when they come out of the Persian Gulf through Strait of Hormuz and then to Bab el-Mandeb and Suez Canal. So, you know, that is also going to have an impact. So I think overall the strategy that is being adopted by the Houthis and the Yemenis is that really they want to sort of really tell the Zionist entity that the people in Gaza, the resistance fighters, the Palestinians in the West Bank, they are not alone.
Okay.
They have friends, just like the Zionist entity has friends in Washington, in London, Paris, and the collective West.
Okay. Now, John, Iran has announced repeatedly that resistance fighters make their decisions on the basis of their own exigencies and interests and act accordingly. Yet the West blaming Tehran for involvement in the Yemeni anti-Israel operations. What's the use and purpose of such blame game?
Well, as a start, let me salute our brothers in Yemen for their strong support for the Palestinians, and salute our brothers in Tehran for the support of the resistance in the Middle East, Iraq, and Lebanon, and Palestine. Let me start just, this is a game which is not obviously a new game. It's an old and new game where the West always had to point the finger somewhere else. Now, with all this coalition of the Western countries, especially the British and the French and the Americans, they're sending actually missionaries who actually killing Palestinians in Gaza, and that is actually it's okay. Yet, by the showing support by Iran to the Yemeni resistance, Iran being accused of supporting the resistance in Yemen, which is just make it clear to the listeners that from day one of the establishment of the Islamic Revolution of Iran,
right,
the first act done by Ayatollah Khomeini is that the closure of the Zionist embassy in Tehran and obviously converted to the Palestinian embassy with the Palestinian ambassador. So Iran is not shy of supporting their resistance. So Iran is not shy to support the Palestinian resistance in Palestine. So I don't understand what the use of actually pointing out that Iran supported the I don't want to call them Houthis because the Yemeni's resistance, I want to divert from the use of a language of Houthis and Yemenis. There is no Houthis and Yemenis. There is the Yemeni resistance who actually did take a good initiative to stop the supply of arms to the Zionist entity through the Red Sea, and that is really appreciated. So I don't understand what's the point of actually citing something which is a clear, agreed, and obviously admitted by the Iranian government.
All right, now, Shabir, how effectively do you think such Yemeni operations like seizing vessels that have dealings with the Israeli regime, all the vessels now heading for Israel, no matter what their nationality is, how effectively could this impact the Israeli economy that's already in a bad situation?
Firstly, I want to thank our brother, the panelists, the fellow panelists, for clarifying that it's not just Houthis, it's the Yemenis. It's absolutely correct that it's the Yemenis overall, which are part of the resistance axis, if you like. So what, look, you know, it may appear that Yemenis are not actually being very sort of effective. But the reality is that, as I said in my opening comment, it is having an impact on freight cost, on insurance, and delays in the products arriving, whether in Europe or particularly to the Zionist entity in Haifa or any other port that the ship will go. So it will delay at least by a week, and that has an impact overall. Already, the Zionist entity is losing billions of dollars because the economy has come to a virtual halt. Many companies have closed down in the Zionist entity. Nearly 100,000 people have moved from the northern part of the Zionist entity to Eilat and other places. And of course, all the sort of settlers who were based in and around Gaza, they have also moved. So the security aspect. And secondly, you know, the reports are that nearly 500,000 Zionists have left the Zionist entity to wherever they came from. You know, many of them have dual passports. So that is also having an impact. So I think the sort of strategy that the Yemenis are following is having an impact. That's the reason why the USA is sort of sending their frigates there, trying to bring down the drones, and so on. If the activities and the actions of the Yemenis was not having impact, then of course the USA would not take any course of action. Secondly, you know, it is trying to bring the Saudis and the UAE back again in the equation to start bombing Yemen. But obviously, Yemenis have warned that if that course of action takes place, then the borders of these two countries are much closer to Yemen than sort of Israel. So that will have an impact in itself, which they did show in the past few years,
right,
that they're capable of launching rockets on Saudi Arabia.
Okay. Now, John, elsewhere in the region, in Iraq, for instance, resistance fighters have also conducted more than 70 drone attacks on U.S. bases, both inside Iraq and Syria. And that, of course, has angered the officials of the White House. Now, what do such reactions from Iraq signify?
Well, just let's make it clear that this is not an operation which started with the genocide in Gaza. The Iraqi resistance for the last, since the fall of the Saddam regime and the American occupation of Iraq, the Iraqi resistance has been actually active daily. But as you know, the Western media will not actually publish anything to do with the Iraqi resistance. It's trying to give the impression that the Iraqi government and the American occupation is on the same page. There is a resistance daily in Iraq, daily in Syria, despite of the civil war in Syria by the Americans and the Zionists to try to overthrow President Assad, you know, which is weakened, trying to weaken the resistance. And they thought with the killing of the Shahid Soleimani that the resistance would die. That's the only reason they assassinate Shahid Soleimani, because they thought with the support of Soleimani, the resistance would die in Iraq. And despite of that, the resistance actually flourished, and there's more attacks on the American Zionist occupation. As you know, they are hiding on the green zone. They actually cannot travel easy and obviously safely in the country because of the resistance. Actually, it's a daily operation against the Iraqis. So it is make a big difference that this a new front will be opened to, as Nasrallah, Sayyid Nasrallah said, and we're keeping a third of the Zionist army in our border fighting, so we can actually ease the pressure on our brothers in Gaza. I think the whole region should be open to the resistance to eliminate this cancer in the Middle East, so-called Israel. And without that, obviously, we sit here and watch the slaughter of the Palestinians daily. So no surprise that the our brothers in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, I mean, we salute Yemenis because of 8 years of starvation and killing, yet the Yemenis supporting the Palestinians despite of the the massacres by the Saudi and the Gulf regimes, who was actually in the camp of the Zionists and the USA. Despite of that, Yemenis is still, and the resistance of Iraq is still fighting with the support of the Hezbollah in the north of Palestine.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Shabir, we have reactions from the Yemenis, from Iraqis, now in Lebanon. Also, Hezbollah has been doing their share of repressive attacks using, you know, their own advanced weaponry to hit Israeli military bases and equipment inside the occupied lines. And it said that almost one-third of the Israeli military is engaging Hezbollah resistance fighters, and thus this weakens its resources in its brutal war on the Gaza Strip. Your take on Hezbollah's performance?
Well, of course, the resistance in Lebanon has really given the Zionist entity a bloody nose in 2006, because that was the year when it is very clear that the Zionist entity lost very badly, and they had to vacate the south, which was liberated first time in the sort of the West Asian history that no Arab nation was able to recapture the territories that were occupied by the Zionist entity. So what has been happening is that the leaders, the military elite in the Zionist entity keeps on sort of using the language that they will use the Dahia doctrine, that is really sort of destroy as many buildings and sort of murder as many civilians as possible that they did in 2006. But nonetheless, the resistance in Lebanon was victorious. So we, you know, and since the beginning of this special operation, as I would like to call, by the resistance in Gaza became effective, really, as Sayyid Nasrullah has said, that they have been involved from day one in sort of resisting and engaging the Zionist entity, because it is very clear that a significant portion, you know, one third or whatever the numbers are, of the military are engaged in the northern theater, if you like, northern or Galilee, the northern part of the Zionist entity south of Lebanon. Right. So in that way, the resources and the personnel that are engaged is having an impact on whatever action the Zionist entity wanted to take in Gaza.
True. Now, John, the United States has again used its veto power and obstructed another push at the UN Security Council for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I want to ask you, on what ground can Washington move against the will of the people around the world and overtly support the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, just keep in mind that this war is not an Israeli-Palestinian war. This is an Israeli-American one side against the Palestinians in Gaza. Though a lot of the Zionist media try to betray the war as Hamas, Israel, watching the some of the Arab, even Arab reactionary regimes media referring to the war in Gaza. It is not a war. A war is between two armies. This is a genocide by the Zionist regime with the support of USA and the corrupt government of UK to obviously to kill as much as they can Palestinians, you know, because the whole aim is to throw the Palestinians and send them to the, as they claim in the beginning, to Sinai, which plan never worked. So we, America has a history of veto the any resolution regard to Israel, and from the 1967, there is 168 resolution from the United Nations regard to the Zionist regime as being vetoed by America. And because the Israelis in that part of the region, they are the lapdog of the United States, they are servant of the American foreign interest and military interest in the region. That's the only reason they actually vetoed the resolution as the what I referred to, the 168 resolution in the past.
Right.
This is the history of the American, obviously, open support of the, not only vetoes, the finance, the billions
of
dollars.
Yeah,
$3.8 billion a year they sent to the Zionist entity to build settlement and to oppress and kill Palestinians.
That's true. Shabir, given what John said, all kinds of, you know, unflinching support that Washington has lent to the Tel Aviv regime, the full-fledged support for, and also direct involvement, actually, in this Israeli carnage of Palestinians. So doesn't the U.S. deserve to see its military bases in West Asia targeted by resistance fighters?
Absolutely, because our other commentator said that, you know, America, the U.S., and our government here in U.K. is supporting this particular entity, and it was Britain here way back over 100 years ago, 1917, under the Balfour Declaration, that the Zionist entity sort of idea was floated. And then, of course, a piece of land was given, which was under the British mandate, to the Zionists to come and occupy it from all over the world. So really, Britain has a sort of ugly history in supporting and creating this particular entity. But of course, Britain is no longer an imperial power, and it has become the lapdog of the US. Therefore, as a poodle, it has to follow whatever Washington diktat is. So in reality, the resistance, wherever they are in West Asia, they know very clearly that behind what's happening in Palestine, Gaza, the West Bank, and other parts of the Zionist entity, really is, with the complete support of the United States and Washington and London, plus the European Union. Because at the end of the day, the hypocrisy, the double standards, whereby, you know, they talk about human rights and all kinds of wonderful words that are used, but they are not applicable as far as the Palestinians are concerned. And it's not only the Palestinians, the language that is being used by the Zionist entities, leaders, the mayor of deputy mayor of Jerusalem only a couple of days ago talked about annihilation of the people in Gaza. Mr. Netanyahu talks about Amaleks. Mr. Gallant talks about human animals and all kinds of language. So the reality is that it's not just the Palestinians who are being dehumanized, but really it's the language of the colonial and imperial powers of the past, when they used to designate the indigenous population of the countries that they were occupying as subhumans. So the language is being used at this moment against the Palestinians, but it really means all the Arabs,